Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news.
We'll begin with the grave situation in Ukraine that appears to be on the brink of civil war, in spite of President Yanukovych's announcement of a truce with the opposition. Anders Aslan, the co-chairman of the Board of Trustees of the Kiev School of Economics and a former Swedish diplomat and economic advisor to the governments of Russia and Ukraine, joins us to discuss the opposition takeover of police stations and the surrender of security forces to the opposition as the European Union discusses sanctions and Russian President Putin warns against Western interference. Then we'll go to Toluca, Mexico, to speak with Tim Johnson, the Mexico City bureau chief for McClatchy Newspapers, who is covering the so-called Three Amigos North American Summit, where President Obama is meeting with Mexican President Peña Nieto and Canadian Prime Minister Stephen Harper to discuss trade, immigration, energy, and other issues. We will discuss what the Mexican and American leaders, who are more popular abroad than they are at home, can come to an agreement on, and whether Prime Minister Harper has succeeded in pressuring President Obama to agree to the controversial Keystone XL pipeline. Then finally, we will speak with Ian Haney-Lopez, a professor of law at the University of California, Berkeley, and author of the new book, Dog Whistle Politics, How Coded Racial Appeals Have Reinvented Racism and Wrecked the Middle Class. We will discuss his groundbreaking analysis of how politicians and plutocrats use veiled racist appeals to persuade white voters to support policies that favor the extremely rich while threatening the real interests of middle class and working Americans. We will also examine the extent to which identity politics on the left play into the hands of these reactionary politicians and plutocrats.
And joining us now is Anders Aslan, who's a senior fellow at the Peterson Institute for International Economics and co-chairman of the Board of Trustees of the Kiev School of Economics. He worked as a Swedish diplomat in Kuwait, Poland, Geneva, and Moscow, served as an economic advisor to the government of Russia, Kyrgyzstan, and Ukraine, and he is the author of How Ukraine Became a Market Economy and Democracy. Welcome to Background Briefing, Anders Aslan.
Thank you very much.
And we're just learning now that President Viktor Yanukovych has sacked the army chief and replaced him with the head of the Ukrainian Navy. Would that indicate that the army chief perhaps didn't want to go as far as Yanukovych wanted him to go in cracking down on protesters?
Yeah, and this was not the first change in the military command. The Minister of Defense, who's originally Russian, has said repeatedly that the military will stay out of a civil conflict in Ukraine, and that its only task is to defend Ukraine's national integrity. So I presume that this is a step in that direction, and the military today made a statement, that is the Minister of Defense, that it could get engaged in anti-terrorist actions, and that is what President Yanukovych now calls his crackdown on the opposition.
So is this, do you think, being implemented to the urging of Putin? I mean, he's basically been, his attitude seems to have been that Yanukovych has to get tough. And of course, he blames this all on Western interference. But is that Yanukovych doing this on his own, or is Putin giving him the kind of backbone to crack down?
Yeah, I think that's the right way of putting it, that President Putin is giving him the backbone to crack down. They did meet on the 6th and 7th of February in Sochi. The expectation before and after was that President Putin had told President Yanukovych that now you had better crack down. And this is exactly what we are seeing. And it was even said President Putin does not mind if this crackdown happens before the Sochi Winter Olympics are still going on. And that's indeed what has happened.
So what does this mean, though, in terms of my understanding was that the army and the armed forces were politically neutral and I suppose, to put it in a facile way, patriotic, and that Yanukovych relied on his sort of cadre of stormtroopers, the palace guard, if you will, and they only number about 7,000, I believe. So if he starts employing the full military, are they reliable?
Hardly. That has been one reason why the military have not been called in before. And a broad assumption previously has been that the military would stay out and that the police would go with the local authorities. That is, in the western half would go to the opposition and the eastern half of the police to the Yanukovych. And that seems to be right. It's highly doubtful that the military can really be used.
Well, there are apparently already reports and video from the western Ukrainian city of Lviv, where soldiers have surrendered to protesters.
Indeed, and this is what you would expect in the western part of Ukraine. But Lviv, Ivano-Frankivsk, and Ternopil, that's 3 out of 25 regions where... you can say Soviet power was never really respected. In these parts of Ukraine, it took 10 years for the Red Army to get control over the guerrilla after the Second World War. So this part of the country is rather special.
And also, I believe, in this part of the country, there have been attacks on police stations as well.
Indeed. It seems that in about half the country... opposition forces have either attacked the police headquarters or taken them over. And the same is true of security services.
So the meeting then that took place between the opposition leaders, the boxer Vitaly Klitschko and Yatsenyuk, they met with President Yukanovich late on Tuesday night, but they failed to come to an agreement. Any indication of what was discussed and why the agreement was not reached?
Well, what Vitaly Klitschko has said is that the only way of solving the conflict now is early parliamentary and presidential elections. What they previously has discussed has been a coalition government or a technical government, but Yanukovych has said no to that and wants to have his own prime minister who should be appointed this week. And the other issue has been to go back to the more balanced constitution that Yanukovych had abolished in a very dubious fashion. And then instead, President Yanukovych sends in the storm troops. So what conversation can you have with such a person? The attitude of the opposition now is clearly that the only thing one can really discuss with President Yanukovych, that is how he will go and how early elections can be organized.
But of course, he is saying, I was a duly elected president, and that is what the Russians are saying. And
that yeah, but a duly elected president is not supposed to steal something like $10 billion, which is what Yanukovych and his family has straightforward stolen from the Ukrainian government, nor is the president supposed to steal a parliamentary election, which is what happened in October 2010.
And what would that theft of from this kleptocratic family, largely led by the president's eldest son, who's a former dentist, who apparently is the one that shakes down the billionaires and basically says, I'm your new partner. What percentage do you think of the country's GDP has this family stolen?
Well, the assessment that is made of how much the family has made is... $12 billion, which is the rumored number, which is, of course, very approximate, but it tells you something about the size. And the GDP of Ukraine is $180 billion. So that leaves 6-7% of the GDP in the hands of the Yanukovych family.
And I take it that this is a subtext of much of the disgust amongst the members of the opposition and you know, they've been, you have to admit that they have really been persistent and they're showing up in the worst weather in the Maidan, the big square. They've been unyielding, have they not? Something is clearly holding. There's some real glue there, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, in particular that last night, that these thousands of stormtroopers could not take the the Maidan. And in the end, 10,000 protesters were still there. But what has happened with the Maidan is that it has become quite militarized. So it's a rather scary place now. And of course, last night, the center of Kiev looked very much like a battlefield, as it indeed was.
So to what extent are these, they're called Tatushki, are they, the government thugs?
Yeah.
Are they the ones that are militarizing the situation, or is it? Is there, obviously there's some reciprocity there?
Well, it's a reciprocity. So Maidan is quite militarily organized in itself. It's organized in battalions. The protesters have put on helmets and bulletproof vests to the extent that they have it. So while so far they have gone with baseball bats, they have thrown stones, and they have not used firearms. Neither side used firearms last night. Even so, 26 people were killed. And next time it would be natural that firearms are being used by both sides. And then we could see a real civil war. This is a frightful situation in Ukraine.
And do you think that Yanukovych understands that, or more importantly, does Putin understand that?
I think that for President Putin, this would mean that Ukraine's attempt to go to towards Europe has ended in tragedy, and that shows that this is something that nobody should do. For President Yanukovych, I think that he's just interested in salvaging himself, not his nation.
Well, but if Putin were to make that justification that this is what democracy brings, chaos and death, that's an assumption that he's going to win, that his side's going to win. Is that your feeling?
It's not my feeling, but my fear is that this will be very bloody at this stage. My only hope is that so many on Yanukovych's side will say that you can't do this. Something has to be done to stop it. And indeed, this morning, President Yanukovych said that it makes no sense to talk to the opposition. They have to give up and be peaceful first. And in the evening, he appointed a commission under his chief of staff, Andriy Kluyev, which is supposed to negotiate with the opposition. So he did turn around during the day, but that is not enough.
Well, we know from that conversation that was leaked clearly by the Russians with the U.S. State Department official and the U.S. ambassador castigating the Europeans for being feckless, I guess, in terms of their support for the Ukrainian opposition. There has been meetings with Klitschko, the opposition leader, the boxer, with Angela Merkel. What's your sense of obviously the Russians are blaming the Europeans for meddling and the Americans for meddling. Is there, how resolute do you think the West are in supporting the opposition?
What it appears today is that the European Union is much more resolute than the United States. The Minister for Foreign Affairs of the European Union met today, and they are preparing personal sanctions against the people most responsible in Ukraine. They did not mention names. The U.S. has clarified that certain people are not allowed visas into the United States, but in either case, the names have been given. It seems right now as if Europe is taking the lead and the U.S. is rather lagging behind.
And what would explain that? Does the U.S. simply not want to confront Putin?
The U.S. has more different interests with Russia. For example, Iran and for some reason Syria is considered to be something that the U.S. should cooperate with Russia on. For Europe, Ukraine is really important.
Well, but the U.S. has been had by the Russians and the Syrians. Kerry has admitted as much.
Yes, indeed. I think so. So too. But if you look up on Iran, the U.S. has a far greater engagement in the Iranian issue than Europe has. Sure. For Europe, Ukraine is far more important than Iran. For the U.S., it's rather the opposite order of priorities.
Well, since Putin is clearly, I think, the main player here, and he's, as we mentioned earlier, giving Yanukovych backbone, I don't think he has much respect for Yanukovych. But why is it then that we treat Putin with respect? I mean, essentially, to my understanding, having spoken to a lot of Russian experts and people that have been persecuted by Putin, obviously they may not be the most objective, but I think if you saw the 60 Minutes piece on Sunday about the Russian lawyer who was murdered in prison,
Magnitsky,
it's pretty clear, I think, that this is a gangster regime and that he's the sort of capo di capo, and that's who he is. And my understanding of gangsters is that at the end of the day, gangsters always crave respect. So why give him respect?
Indeed, I think that you're perfectly right that the best results with President Putin are accomplished when one stands up against him. And indeed, the one recent result President Obama has had with President Putin is after he publicly insulted President Putin at a press conference in August, and before that had said that he was not going to Moscow for bilateral summit with President Putin. Then President Putin came up with this chemical disarmament proposal for Syria. It was entirely because the U.S., as a change, stood up against President Putin. Of course, that's what should be done again.
But it's not necessarily what is being done.
Indeed. I think the wrong policy, a far too soft policy, is being pursued by the U.S. with regard to Ukraine, and it can turn out to be very costly indeed.
Well, Anders Aslan, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Again, I've been speaking with Anders Aslan, who's a senior fellow at the Peterson Institute for International Economics and co-chairman of the Board of Trustees of the Kiev School of Economics. He worked as a Swedish diplomat in Kuwait, Poland, Geneva, and Moscow, and served as an economic advisor to the governments of Russia, Kyrgyzstan, and Ukraine, and is the author of How Ukraine Became a Market Economy and Democracy.
We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back and go to Toluca, Mexico, for an update on the Three Amigos North American Summit.